From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. House Democrats are hearing from former Ambassador Kurt Volker today. He was the top State Department representative to Ukraine until last week when he resigned amid the whistleblower complaint about President Trump's phone call with the Ukrainian president. That complaint led to the impeachment inquiry that Democrats have launched, and they're now asking for Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Attorney General William Barr to recuse themselves from Ukraine matters because Barr was named in the complaint and Pompeo was on the call. And now many are looking at Vice President Mike Pence's possible involvement. The Washington Post's Greg Jaffe has been reporting on that and joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks.
So your reporting for the Post says that President Trump repeatedly involved Pence in efforts to exert pressure on Ukraine's president to dig up dirt on the Bidens. Tell us more.
Yeah. So Pence was largely, I think, unaware of how he was being used precisely. But he was supposed to go to Zelensky's inauguration on May 20th. Plans were in their kind of early stages, and many people on the NSC, the sort of Russia-Ukraine-Europe experts, wanted him to go. Sort of a vote of confidence for Zelensky, who sees the U.S. as really a bulwark against Russian aggression, and Trump pulled him back from that trip. Then Pence goes again and meets with Zelensky on September 1st in person when Trump cancels the trip and delivers a message about corruption, which has long been an issue with the U.S. and Ukraine. But, you know, for the Ukrainians coming off that July 25th call, I think would have clearly heard that as move forward on the Biden investigation.
Now, in terms of that inauguration trip that Pence was supposed to take but didn't, and that was canceled by the order of President Trump, do we know why Trump did that? And did Pence know why Trump said don't go?
No, I think at that point, we don't precisely know why Trump did it, and we don't precisely know what Pence knew. You know, the vice president's office will say, well, you know, there was nothing unusual about this, that he had other plans. He was planning a trip for Canada around that time. He had a campaign event in Jacksonville, Florida around that time. And the inauguration date, it was moving from the Ukrainian. So they were having trouble pinning it down. He wanted to go but couldn't, essentially.
And in terms of the September 1st visit when Pence traveled to Warsaw to meet with Zelensky and told Zelensky that aid wouldn't be released because of concerns over corruption, how have Pence's aides responded to your questions about what Pence knew about that?
Well, that's interesting. So Pence's national security advisor was on the call on July 25th. Mm-hmm. But I think from talking to Pence officials, that person didn't find anything sort of remarkable about the call and so didn't report up to Pence's office the request from the president to investigate the Bidens. Pence should have been afforded a transcript of that call. We think he got it. His people seem to think he got it. What's unclear is whether he read it or not. Our understanding is that if he read it, he has no memory of having read it. It would have been basic preparation for a meeting with a foreign official, another foreign head of state, when you're standing in for the president, to have read the transcript before you go into the meeting, especially because the Ukraine aid is being held up at that time and the White House hasn't offered a good explanation. So you would really want to know why the president had – what the president had told the Ukrainian president about why it was being held up. And so Pence, it seems like, was either not especially well prepared or probably not as curious as he should have been.
Well, and it would be pretty stunning if one didn't find that transcript, which we've seen the partial transcript, remarkable, because in it, President Trump said to the Ukrainian president, I want you to do us a favor, though, and look into the Bidens.
Yeah, you would think that that would jump out at people. I mean, I think one of the arguments we've heard from people, not for attribution, is that, you know, Trump's calls with foreign leaders tend to be consistently pretty outrageous. I think we know that from the transcripts that have been released. So you sort of become inured to it over time. Mm-hmm. That's not a great excuse, but that's the one we're getting.
Now, you write in this piece that Pence often seems to be out of the loop on major issues. Is that likely to insulate him from political fallout this time?
You know, I don't know. It could. Yeah, that does seem to be the case. You know, looking back to a couple of sort of larger incidents, Pence is out. But his people kind of like to have it both ways. They like to say he's a key advisor to the president, one of the president's most trusted advisors. But they also like to say that he's out of the loop when things go wrong. So it's tough to have it both ways.
So where does this go from here? Where does your reporting take you next on this story, Greg?
You know, I'm not sure. I think one of the things we're trying to establish is, you know, exactly how beyond this one call was the Trump administration putting pressure on the Ukrainians? What did that pressure campaign look like? The vice president's trip seemed to be one kind of obvious element of it, but I think we need to understand how it worked.
That is Washington Post national security reporter Greg Jaffe. Thank you.
Sure, no problem. Thank you.
If you were near a TV or online yesterday, you probably saw it. The very strong reactions inside and outside of the Dallas courtroom where police officer Amber Geiger was sentenced to 10 years in prison for killing her upstairs neighbor, Botham Jean, after she entered his apartment last year thinking it was her own. There was one thing that happened that is rarely, if ever, seen in a courtroom. It happened when Jean's 18-year-old brother, Brant, gave his victim impact statement. He urged Geiger to turn over her life to Christ and forgave her.
I don't know if this is possible, but can I give her a hug, please? Please?
Yes.
Outside, many of the protesters were confused and angry that Geiger was only sentenced to 10 years in prison for killing a person. Joining us to talk about all of this is NPR's Wade Goodwin. Thanks for joining us, Wade.
It's my pleasure.
First of all, it's not uncommon to hear during a victim impact statement a loved one talking about forgiveness. But in this case, John's brother went a step further and actually hugged Geiger. This is something that's really rarely seen in a courtroom. What's been the reaction to this?
Well, I think there's been, you know, a variety of reactions. It's helpful to understand that this was a Saint Lucian who has come to this country, and, you know, it was a Saint Lucian hug. And I think the experience of growing up in Saint Lucia, being black, is quite a different one than growing up here.
And you're saying it's a cultural difference.
And a political difference. Yeah, I do. I think that, there is a history here of repression and Jim Crow that has led to understandable resentment, which makes that hug seem a little harder to understand from an American point of view than it might would from a St. Lucian point of view.
Okay, then there was the judge, Tammy Kemp. She was in tears as Botham's brother, Brant, spoke, and she also hugged and handed Geiger a Bible. I've covered a lot of criminal court cases, and I've never seen this happen, a judge acting in such a personal way. How are people reacting to all of this as well?
Well, she also read a passage from the Bible and came up to Geiger and said, "This is where you need to start." And then, you know, gave her her personal Bible and hugged her. And yes, I have never seen anything like it.
Botham Jean's mother, Allison, has been very critical of police training. She spoke with CBS.
There is a lot that has to be done by the Dallas Police Department, by the Texas Rangers, by the city of Dallas.
What are police officers in Dallas saying about all of this? I think we heard the police chief late yesterday.
Well, Renee Hall, the Dallas police chief, who is black, held a press conference and conceded that, you know, there was trouble in River City. The evidence showed that Amber Geiger was treated in a way after she had shot and killed John, you know, in the hour afterwards. In the few minutes afterwards, in a way that no regular citizen ever would be treated. I mean, given, you know, all kinds of access to, I mean, the union rep came down, pulled her out of a police car where she had been isolated, told the sergeant to turn off the camera that was inside the car, which they did, and then took Geiger away from the car to talk privately with her. I mean, can you imagine any other citizen enjoying that kind of treatment? And she was arrested, but she was never jailed. I mean, if you shoot someone dead in their house, you're going away from that scene in handcuffs, but not Amber Geiger. You know, she wasn't actually arrested until 3 days later. So this angered the Jean family, I think rightfully so. And I think that's what Chief Hall was speaking to, is that, you know, this created a very bad perception. This was not good training, and the Dallas Police Department has some work to do. The Dallas Police Department is understaffed. and they have had trouble attracting officers, and I think that's part of the dynamic here, too.
Yeah. Geiger is, she's up for parole in 5 years. How will all of this, the reactions in the courtroom, and specifically the family forgiving her and the judge making that decision to hug her and to give her her Bible, how will this weigh on her chances for an early release?
If she's a model prisoner, if she shows, you know, real remorse and a real effort to rehabilitate herself, that will weigh in. But so will the crime. So if I were a betting man, I would bet it would be more than 5 years and less than 10.
Wade Goodwin is an NPR reporter based in Dallas. Wade, thank you so much for your time.
You're quite welcome.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
There are places in the United States where voting districts are made up mostly of prisoners who can't vote.
Forgive me for not having been able to articulate this the way I want to, but it's almost like your body being used.
On NPR's Code Switch, the connection between the U.S. Census, politics, and prisons.
Doctors have noticed something lately. Their patients who suffer from arthritis are asking by name for CBD, a cannabis extract, to help manage pain. But there's so much confusion about where to buy it, how to take it, and if it's even legal, which it is, that now the Arthritis Foundation has put together some guidelines to help patients figure this all out. Joining us now is Dan Claw, a rheumatologist at the University of Michigan, who helped develop the guidelines. Dan, welcome.
Thank you.
So CBD, or cannabidiol, is everywhere right now. So what's the bottom line? Should people with arthritis continue or consider using it to manage their pain?
They should consider using it. It appears as though CBD is fairly safe and it might be effective in certain types of pain. The biggest concern about CBD is knowing your source of CBD and making sure that you're not in some way consuming CBD that is in some way contaminated, either with THC or with any number of other chemicals, you know, depending on how it's been manufactured and processed.
And explain THC and why that combination could potentially be harmful.
THC is the psychoactive component of cannabis or marijuana, whereas CBD is a different cannabinoid that's in marijuana that is not psychoactive, and in fact, it even protects against the high you get from THC. So if people are trying CBD for pain, we know that CBD is quite safe. When you add THC to that, the safety changes because that is the psychoactive component of cannabis. Then you have a risk of dependence and addiction and a number of other things. So yeah, I think it's important for people to understand that when they're going the sort of cannabis route, CBD is something quite different than something that might contain THC.
You are a doctor. How often are patients asking about this?
All the time. And it's not just for pain. You know, out on the internet, people are purporting that CBD is effective for almost everything. So a lot of patients are coming and asking their providers. Most providers haven't been educated or trained in the appropriate medicinal use of cannabinoids and especially CBD. So a lot of people, unfortunately, are out there flying blind. You know, they don't have the guidance that they would want or that we would like them to have, you know, when they're trying to seek the appropriate use of these types of products.
So what's the best way to take it? A pill form, drops, lotion, something else? Give us an idea for those who now they've cleared it with their doctor and they want to take this next step.
The best way to take CBD is probably some type of oral administration, either a pill or a gummy bear or a tincture. It's not a good idea to vape or in any way take CBD via any kind of sort of inhaled or respiratory route. We see some of the problems that are occurring now with vaping, that almost certainly is from contaminants in the vaped products. But be that as it may, it's just an inherently more dangerous route of administration.
And because it's not, going into your lungs.
Right, yes. It's going into your lungs. And it's not necessary for appropriate medicinal use. If you take CBD orally, it will start working within, you know, a half hour or an hour. There's no reason you would need to get that really rapid onset of action that inhaling a drug would give. The other thing we should talk about are topicals or lotions. CBD, unless it's prepared with something else in it that helps it penetrate through the skin, does not penetrate through the skin very well at all. So people are probably wasting a fair amount of money with topicals that don't have anything else in it besides CBD. Because, again, pure CBD or THC or any form of the cannabinoid, they're very lipid-soluble, fat-soluble, and thus just putting a cannabinoid on the skin, very little of it is going to be absorbed. So both the topical route of administration, which is quite popular, and the inhaled route of administration are probably suboptimal compared to just somehow taking it orally.
What should we be looking for in a quality CBD product?
Well, first of all, look for something that's been tested and labeled by some sort of regulatory body. More and more states, as they either decriminalize or pass legal marijuana laws, are putting mandatory testing programs in place. And this is really essential because this is really, I think, the biggest problem or biggest danger right now with CBD is that people don't know what they're getting. They don't know if it's pure. People have to be particularly careful if they have any type of employment where they're getting, for example, random urine drug screens, because a very small amount of THC that is allowed in your CBD could be enough to flip a urine drug screen to be positive for an individual. So people that are, for example, getting urine drug tests have to be even more vigilant about where they get their CBD from.
This really is a legal gray zone, as the Arthritis Foundation says, because you as a doctor, you understand the benefits of it, but yet there are all these complexities based on where it's legal and based on having other components in it like THC. Do you worry about this at all?
Yeah, I worry about it a great deal. And again, I think we're already seeing with the vaping deaths and injuries that if people aren't careful, these products can be very dangerous, especially if they're in some way sort of adulterated or contaminated. We still need to know more about just pure THC and pure CBD, but when you start then, you know, having products that are contaminated with all sorts of different things, it's sort of the Wild West out there, unfortunately.
Dan Claw is a rheumatologist at the University of Michigan who helped develop these new guidelines for the Arthritis Foundation on CBD use. Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have a link to the full guidelines at hereandnow.org.
The impeachment inquiry in the U.S. has put a spotlight on Ukraine. So let's learn more about the country with Serhii Plokhii, who is professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard. Welcome back.
Well, it's my pleasure to be back.
So parts of Ukraine have been controlled by a range of powers over the centuries, including Lithuania, Poland. It was, of course, part of the Soviet Union, gained independence in 1991. How has Ukraine found itself so stuck between the West and Russia since then?
Well, Ukraine declared independence on December 1st, 1991. And 1 week after that, the Soviet Union was gone. So Russia didn't think that the entire Union enterprise was worth it without Ukraine. The reason is Ukraine was at that time, Ukraine remains today, to be the second largest economy and country in terms of population after Russia in the Soviet space or post-Soviet space. So there is a lot at stake when it comes to developments in Ukraine, either in 91 or today.
And Ukraine is not a member of NATO, which is why NATO did not step in after Crimea was annexed by Russia.
Exactly. Ukraine is not part of NATO. And when NATO was expanded to the east, many in Ukraine were really worried that Ukraine would end up to be in no man's land between Russia, that would try to reclaim its control, at least influence over the region, and the expanded NATO. And unfortunately, those people who were worried about that back in 94, in 95, 96, history turned them to be right.
Why didn't Ukraine become part of NATO?
Well, there are two reasons. First of all, that Ukrainians as a whole, as a nation, were not ready to do that. Mm-hmm. Second, everyone was concerned about Russia's reaction. Ukraine and Georgia were received a promise to become part of NATO, and that was in the year 2008. And the immediate reaction was Russian invasion of Georgia. So that
put a stop to those plans.
Right, exactly.
So let's talk about the leadership of Ukraine. The current president is Zelensky, clearly friendly to the United States, but that hasn't always been the case since the collapse of the Soviet Union. There was Viktor Yushchenko, who was friendly to the West but was poisoned in 2004. Then there was Viktor Yanukovych, who was more friendly to Russia and was ousted in a revolution in 2014, then Petro Poroshenko, more pro-West. Why this back and forth?
Well, one of the reasons is history. And different parts of Ukraine belonged historically to different regions and empires. And eastern part of Ukraine for a long period of time was part of the Russian Empire, western part of Habsburg mm-hmm. Empire. And there are much closer ties historically and economically between eastern Ukraine and Russia than between western Ukraine and Russia.
So it's still a divided country, basically.
It was very much a divided country before the Russian annexation mm-hmm. of the Crimea. But since then, what we see is that Ukrainian electorate actually is much more united, is much more homogeneous than it was before. For example, the elections in 2014 of President Poroshenko, the overwhelming majority of Ukrainians voted for one candidate. The same happened with President Zelensky. And this is new development after the war.
So as a professor of Ukrainian history and a Ukrainian-American yourself, what has been your reaction to Ukraine's place in this impeachment inquiry?
Well, I think I'm more or less in sync with the most of Ukrainians today who are very unhappy to find Ukraine in the middle of a political fight in the United States. Ukraine very much depends on the goodwill and support of European countries, but especially the United States. And what that means is that Ukraine is interested in bipartisan support. And it became a major issue in war between Democrats and Republicans in the United States, something that certainly is not good for Ukraine.
That is Serhii Plokhii, who is a professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard. His new book is Forgotten Bastards of the Eastern Front, American Airmen Behind the Soviet Lines and the Collapse of the Grand Alliance. You're listening to Here and Now.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
In classic fashion, October is shaping up to be a spooky month for investors. Yesterday, all of September's gains were wiped out following a new report that shows manufacturing in the U.S. at its worst since 2009. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Jeremy.
So even with the drops in recent days, the market still appears to be near record highs. You say, however, that by one measure, it's not. Explain.
It's kind of weird if you think about all the stomach lining we've shed since, take January 2018, and I'm quoting Bloomberg here. In the period since, the S&P 500 has hit 18 fresh records. It's had a correction, a near 20% loss, two more declines of 6% this year. And after yesterday, you saw the first back-to-back declines of 1% a year. You put it all into the blender, and afterwards, we're told that the index has done nothing since January 2018.
Well, let's talk about some of the reasons for this week's drops. The Dow dropped 500 points yesterday, more than 800 points just in this very young month so far. Some say this is just October. It's always more volatile than other months. But what else is behind the drop?
Well, let's talk about October for a second. You think about the three defining market meltdowns of the past century. There was 1929. I mean, I was there. I remember it vividly. 1987, 2008. We all remember that. And you add to that this time around a confluence of anxieties for this October. We have the trade talks, if you remember those. They're set to continue in a few weeks with China. The UK is going to face an end-of-month Brexit deadline. What if it has to crash out, like Boris Johnson suggests? And the Federal Reserve is going to meet again at the end of the month, and everybody is talking about impeachment, by the way. So that is a tremendous amount of headline risk in a historic, you know, month for declines.
Well, let's talk about the manufacturing piece of this. This new manufacturing report from the Institute for Supply Management shows some of the weakest manufacturing in the U.S. in 10 years. And pins it on the trade war, which, if we remember correctly, President Trump was talking about the fact that the tariffs were going to help domestic manufacturing.
Yeah, but that takes time for that three-point turn to happen. For China, you know, there's going to be interim pain with the trade war and for the jobs to truly come back here. And in the interim, it certainly doesn't help that the U.S. dollar, our greenback, is so strong relative to other currencies. And you combine that with the trade headwinds and all the stockpiled inventories that we're talking about, and you're just seeing new orders for our wares slumping, both exports and domestic demand for factory orders.
And yet consumer spending, which makes up 70% of the domestic GDP, still going strong.
Yeah, but you know, the worry is going to snowball if and when you see this manufacturing pullback result in more idled factories, more layoffs. We're starting to see that anecdotally in Michigan. Are we going to see publicly traded manufacturers step up to announce earnings shortfalls? They're going to mothball projects and actually issue pink slips. Don't take for granted that the unemployment rate is still near a 50-year low.
And when you say we're starting to see that anecdotally in Michigan, do you mean because of the UAW strike that's been going on there?
That's right. I mean, you're already seeing increased furloughed workers across the supply chain. But that has to be looked at in the context, Jeremy, of stockpiling inventories for car makers. They've been complaining about sedans. How much of that sagging demand is economic? I think that's the question on everybody's mind right now, because GM certainly has enormous inventories. It doesn't have to have these factories running at full tilt, even if the UAW wasn't on its case.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
An update on Senator Bernie Sanders, who's in the hospital, recovering after he had two stents put in following chest pain. His campaign says he'll take about a week off from the campaign trail, and he says he's feeling good. He managed to put a plug in for one of his policies, Medicare for All. He tweeted, "None of us know when a medical emergency might affect us, and no one should fear going bankrupt if it occurs. Medicare for All!" Exclamation point. But this hospitalization is raising questions about his health and a familiar topic, his age. Senator Sanders is 78 years old, and that came up in an interview last month with Dr. Oz.
If elected, you would be age 79 when inaugurated, which will make you the oldest president to have ever gone through that process. Mm-hmm. You see a benefit of the wisdom that comes with 79 years of experience.
Look, I think if people look at my life's work, which has involved standing up to almost every powerful special interest in this country, I think people will be impressed by that record.
The other two Democratic frontrunners are also in their 70s, Senator Elizabeth Warren and former Vice President Joe Biden. Even though voters would prefer a younger candidate, a poll from Pew Research Center in May found that only 3% of the Democrats polled see the 70s as an ideal age for a president. Democrats overwhelmingly want a candidate in their 40s, 50s, or 60s. And recent Democrats we've had in that range, President Obama was 47 when elected, Bill Clinton was 46, JFK was 43. He was the youngest president to be elected. The oldest was a Republican, Ronald Reagan, who was 73 when he won a second term. 73 is also the age of our current president, Donald Trump. So chances are our next president may just be a septuagenarian. We all have our favorites, art pieces that instantly tug at our hearts, evoke an emotion, take us to a specific place in time. For the last few months, art lovers from around the world have descended onto LA's California African American Art Museum to capture that feeling through the iconic painting Sugar Shack. You might know Sugar Shack as the cover art of Marvin Gaye's 1976 album, I Want You. I remember it as a kid watching Good Times in syndication. I always looked forward to it at the end of the credits. Good time, anytime you need a payment. Good time,
anytime you need a free. Good time. You know what I always thought growing up watching Good Times was that JJ actually did this painting. Did you think that when you...
Yeah, I did. I thought that he was the painter who painted this beautiful painting on the wall.
Sam Cruz, who was visiting from Alabama, and I weren't alone in thinking this. The actual painter is the late Ernie Barnes, a professional football star in the late 50s and early 60s. Barnes is best known for his art, creating vibrant depictions of exaggerated and elongated bodies in motion on canvas. Luz Rodriguez worked for Barnes and helped in the curation of the artwork here at the CAM.
He said that if he hadn't played football, a lot of his work wouldn't appear it. Like it did, because he understood the athleticism.
There's athleticism even in the paintings that aren't of athletes.
Yes.
And the limbs and the muscles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he has a thing about strong women, strong black women especially. Like, take, for instance, My Miss America. This was done in the 70s, and this was way before they had a black Miss America. And so Ernie did this painting saying his Miss America is a strong black woman standing undaunted, moving forward, because he knew growing up in the South during the 30s and 40s that, you know, black women didn't have a lot of power.
The exhibit takes visitors on a journey through Barnes's life, his childhood in Durham, North Carolina, his football career, the evolution of his paintings, and the decades Barnes spent living in L.A.'s Fairfax District until he died in 2009. The undeniable star of Barnes's exhibit is the Sugar Shack.
It kind of reminds me of the scene of The Color Purple in the shack.
Yeah, right. It was an inspiration for that, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Over the summer, lines were out the door, people waiting to stand in front of this 3x4-foot canvas to take a selfie or simply take it all in. Barnes has said the idea for this painting was inspired by a dance he snuck into in a Durham armory in North Carolina. He was 13 years old. There he saw them, men and women hypnotized by the drums, limbs loosened by the percussion, and the sounds of the horns. And everyone's eyes, like in the painting, were closed. Jessie Adamson, here from Toronto, Canada, notices the twisting bodies first. She's captivated by the movement.
The figures are almost like ghostly, like spectral, sort of. So, yeah, like, I think it's definitely like... The color produces energy, but also like something kind of the past, or suggesting maybe like a ghostly like thing. So it's a little haunting, I guess.
There are the obvious things people see in the Sugar Shack painting. The woman in yellow, the lady front and center so into the groove she has to hold up her dress. Then there are the subtle things, like the security guard crouched in a chair behind the dancers in the background. And way up at the top left of the painting, a sign that says, Dance Contest at Elvira's. Andres Guzman of New Jersey notices it for the first time.
I don't know why. I'm reminded of, like, the Harlem Renaissance. Like, I don't know if they threw these little parties in their apartments where they provided free food and all that stuff. But this now, that's what I'm getting, like, a lot of that. They invited musicians. Yeah. And it was basically a way to collect money for the community. So that little sign right there just triggered that whole... I never thought of Harlem when I saw this. Never did. But that sign right there kind of did it for me.
Up walks Carrie Hall, visiting from England. The painting looks familiar, reminds her of home.
The detail in some of the photos are absolutely amazing. Absolutely gorgeous. I didn't even realize, and I'm learning now today, that he drew this particular photo here. Really big in London as well, this particular photo.
Where do you know it from?
I've seen it in... Well, not exactly. There's a part in East London that there's a photo on the street that sort of inspired, reminds you of this photo in particular. So it's quite interesting to see it right there in your face. It's quite amazing to see it because it's a really iconic photo. I just see everyone, I don't know, I just see love and vibes, very good positive vibes. just people enjoying themselves for being who they are.
The capturing of that spirit, the essence of humanity, it's what drew L.A. attorney Jim Epstein to become a Barnes collector.
I met Ernie Barnes back in the 70s. My law partner at that time was a friend of Ernie. He introduced me, and I bought two paintings from him, and then I commissioned him to do a painting of my Great Dane, which he did.
Epstein owns the iconic Sugar Shack painting, which, when he isn't loaning it out to museums like CAM, is proudly on display in his rec room.
You know, I just love it. I love the elongation. I love the atmosphere. I love the closed eyes. I see things I've never noticed before quite a bit. Oh, it's great. I've loaned it out at least three or four times over the last 5 years, at least. And a great reaction to this. Best investment I ever made.
Sam Cruz of Alabama says the painting takes him back to a time when life was simple and all it took was a Friday night get-together and some friends to feel good.
We are from Alabama, and yeah, we wanted to come to see some black art, you know, because I like to have a painting of that, take home, put on my wall.
Me too.
For a time, during the height of the Black is Beautiful movement in the 70s, people actually did have Sugar Shack on their walls. Childhood friends Deborah Moore Rainey and Arlene Goff say just about everyone they knew in Kansas City had a print.
I don't know. What year was this?
This was 1976.
That's the year I graduated high school. Of course, we all had the Marvin album, and this was on the cover of his album, so we all had a copy of this piece back in the day, you know. Family room, I think it was. Yeah. How about you, Deb?
Yeah, in my mother's family room, yes. She had a copy, and yes.
I didn't know that. So this was copied, and people would have it framed on their walls.
Yes. Yes, they would. Yes. Just enjoyed looking at it every day. Yeah. Remembering good times.
The Sugar Shack, a national treasure, now gaining popularity through the eyes of new audiences.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is in Florida today meeting with Venezuelan leaders as the U.S. continues to try and ease suffering in the country, which is dealing with hyperinflation and an historic humanitarian crisis. The government of Nicolas Maduro continues to hold on to power despite steady opposition from Juan Guaido, who is recognized as Venezuela's rightful leader by the U.S. and more than 50 other countries. The person by Maduro's side is also one of the most powerful people in the country. That would be his wife, Celia Flores, who doesn't call herself the First Lady, but rather the first revolutionary combatant. Joining us now with more on her is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hannah Dreyer. And Hannah, before you won a Pulitzer, you were an AP reporter in Caracas. Tell us who Celia Flores is and why she is so powerful.
So people in Venezuela tend to talk about Celia like the Lady Macbeth of Caracas. The perception is that she's sort of the power behind Nicolas Maduro in a lot of ways. She came from the slums, she became a lawyer, and then she became very close to Hugo Chavez, which is crucial if you're going to be in power in Venezuela these days. Mm-hmm. And from then on, she's just had this sort of meteoric political career. She's married to Nicolas Maduro, but she's also very powerful in her own right. She was the attorney general of the country, and she ran the Congress for many years.
And how does she exercise that power?
Well, so Celia is known for being very loyal to the cause and for demanding loyalty from everyone around her. So people who she is friends with, people who she favors, can rise up really quickly. One of them became the head of the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And people who cross her tend to end up out of power. Hmm. She's also notorious for nepotism. At one point, she got in trouble when she was running Congress because she had 40 members of her family on the payroll. Hmm. And people were joking that there were so many relatives of hers that if you said Flores in the Congress, everybody would turn around.
She also has had rumors that have followed her, including that she has major drug trafficking connections. In 2015, This all blew up when something called the Narco Sobrino affair happened. Tell us what that was.
So this happened at a time that a lot of high up officials in Venezuela were under investigation for drug trafficking and corruption. And there was a sense that the DEA was sort of closing in. And then one day, everybody in the country was shocked because we heard that two nephews of Celia's had been arrested in Haiti and extradited to the U.S. And that just seemed unthinkable. And U.S. prosecutors said that these two nephews, who were sort of nobodies, had been planning to sell a lot of cocaine and use the proceeds to help the Chavistas win an election.
And the implication is that Celia Flores would have known that they were doing this?
Exactly. The implication was that this was the first crack in the structure that Celia Flores had built, a structure of corruption, nepotism, and real power. And people thought that the two nephews might flip, and this might be the beginning of the end for that structure. It turned out they held firm. They both got long prison sentences, but they don't appear to have sold anybody else out.
And this is where you came into the story, because as they were being arrested, the police in Venezuela grabbed you off the street where you were reporting in Chavez's hometown and tried to use you as collateral?
That's right. It probably wasn't the smartest time for me to go to Chavez's hometown, which is this very rural area. But the secret police grabbed me. They didn't identify themselves. I thought it was a kidnapping. Finally, they took me to headquarters. And yeah, they said that they were going to keep me there for a long time and they weren't going to let me go until they could trade me for these two nephews.
So how did you get released?
Well, I think in part these secret police officers were sort of freelancing and eventually a much higher level member of the political police came in and basically told them that they had to let me go.
Now, as you mentioned, you were let go, but the nephews of Celia Flores are still in prison. How did people in Venezuela react when they found out that the First Lady was involved in this drug scandal?
For a lot of people, it seemed to just confirm what everybody had suspected. But the Maduro administration is so good at this, they quickly turned it to their advantage and started talking about how the Narco Sobrinos had been kidnapped and how this was just another example of the U.S. meddling in Venezuela's affairs. They basically made it into a talking point overnight.
So she keeps a low profile, but do you think that she is in any way part of the reason why the U.S. and other countries have not been able to make a deal with Maduro to leave power and to leave Venezuela? Because she's such a true believer, because she's so powerful, is she stopping that from happening?
The people who have flipped on the Maduro administration, the people who really are in the best position to know, say that Celia is Maduro's closest advisor. So yeah, it's really hard to believe that Maduro would do something that she didn't approve of. And so far, she doesn't seem to be interested in ceding any ground or taking an amnesty deal.
That is Hannah Dreyer, who's a reporter now at The Washington Post, used to be at ProPublica and the AP in Caracas, Venezuela. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And Here It Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.